You know, it's interesting, we hear a lot about Islamophobia. Well, I like the bumper sticker that says, you can't be Islamophobic against people that want to kill you. So that's what I believe, and I truly believe that...
Hello, good evening. Starting a little bit late tonight. Normally we get started about 12:15 or maybe latest 12:30, but we're starting a little after 1 today. Why? Because my sleep schedule was a little bit off and different today because it was Tanit Esther, which is a fast day, which I usually do try to observe anyway, but specifically this year, we're fasting, hoping that the hostages being held by Hamas get free. Also, earlier in the day on Thursday, there was a worldwide recitation of the Shema Yisrael, and that's the statement of Jewish faith and the one God, and that was hopefully as many people did it as know the Shema, and maybe more people that don't know it even learned it today, hopefully. But anyway, I wasn't eating, so I ended up taking a nap to try and save energy, and so we got started late, so deal with it. Today, I saw a video of a older gentleman, a British guy, and it made me remember something. But it was also a really cool, just cool, inspiring kind of video, and I like what he was saying. So I want you to watch and listen to what this gentleman says, and then I'll go into what it made me think of after you've watched it.
That's the car, kid. We are English, mate. We're all brothers. We got Millwall, we got West Ham, we got Man United, we got Chelsea. We've had enough of these Palestinians fucking showing Jewish hatred and hatred towards Jewish people. We fought Nazis and we'll fight them again. We are British and we'll
So obviously, you know, they had to censor him. It was a little bit beep in there, but he was saying basically, we're British and we're tired of these Palestinians coming here hating on the Jews. The British fought the Nazis and they're ready to do it again. And yes, I would support crowning that guy as the King of England, because he also took the time to mention all the hooligan firms and say that we were all united against it. And that was hella respectable. But what did he make me think of? So what he made me think of was this concept that is always being called pseudo-historic, pseudo-scientific, and above all, racist. And the concept I'm talking about is British Israelism. If you've never heard of British Israelism, you're like, what the fuck is that? British Israelism is the idea that the British people are the descendants of one of the lost tribes of Israel. Now, has it been used in racist context before? Probably. Just like anything can be twisted to be used by racists, because racists don't normally come up with anything original. They steal from other things, you know. There is some talk that British Israelism combined with the story of the curse of Ham was the reason why they felt comfortable engaging with the slave trade, which was run by the Arabs, of course. But they felt comfortable engaging in that because supposedly they believed that the Africans were cursed by the sin of Ham, which was uncovering his father's nakedness. His father was Noah. And Noah had passed out drunk, and one of his sons went and pulled the blanket off of him, and he was naked underneath. And so that was the sin that cursed his descendants, the Hamites. And the Hamites were somehow eventually associated with Africa. Now, that bit of British Israelism is not what I'm promoting right now. I don't believe that people of Africa are cursed with dark skin or any retarded thing like that. What I'm talking about is just the basic concept, the idea that the British people may be descendants of the Israelites. And this brought another theory to my mind, which was something that I thought of years ago. And then, I mean, there may have been a little bit of confirmation bias upon my searching for this, but I found that there were other people who had the same theory. And that theory is essentially that Skota, the mother of the Celts, is actually biblical Batya, the daughter of the Pharaoh, who tried to, you know, who picked Moses up out of the water, and didn't want her father, the Pharaoh, to, you know, kill all the Jews or whatever. And she was banished and she went off on a boat. Then the Celts have a story where this woman arrived from Egypt, daughter of a Pharaoh, arrived on a boat. So this to me would suggest then that the Celts are at least partially descendants of the Egyptians. And it would make perfect sense with the Celts being descendants of the Egyptians and the British being descendants of the Israelites, why there has been historical tension between the Irish, Scottish, and English. Deeper. The early Jews, the early Hebrews, wrote in Paleo Hebrew. If you look at like the old coins from Israel, they're not written in the kind of softer script of the modern Hebrew, right? Paleo Hebrew is very similar visually and structurally to the Elder Rune Futhark, which was the language of the Northlands. So we have a couple theories that all seem to kind of fit together here. And we're going to delve into this a little bit. So first off, I want to talk about some things that had to do with the meanings. And I found this interesting article. It's called The Hebrew Alphabet and the Elder Futhark Runes. Of course, Jews, we call it Hebrew Aleph Bet because the first letter is the Aleph. But regardless, it's still considered an alphabet or an abjad, whatever. An abjad is an alphabet in which the consonants are mainly displayed. So let's check out this idea. So this person's research project essentially was finding parallels and correspondences between the two language systems. So this guy says, quote, "Both alphabets consist of symbols imbued with mystical meanings and have been used for spiritual, magical, and divinatory purposes. By examining some of these connections, we can gain a deeper understanding of the universal themes and the spiritual concepts that permeate both languages." And he goes into not the appearance of the letters, but the meaning. And his interpretation, or whatever research he did on the Hebrew meaning of it, is more, I would say, a study of almost like Kabbalistic gematria rather than basic Hebrew linguistics. But I'll just give you a few examples. I'm not going to read through the whole article here, but I'll give you a few examples. The Aleph, which is the beginning, number one, represents unity, oneness, the first and the infinite, which also is represented in Fehu, the rune. Both Aleph and Fehu represent initial spark of creation, carrying the essence of the divine source that brings forth abundance and prosperity. Let's skip ahead down to some other ones. Zion, sword, struggle, spiritual warfare, and Thursaz, conflict, protection, and force. Zion and Thursaz, the rune, symbolize the concept of struggle and the role it plays in spiritual growth. So this guy, if you want to look this up, if you, you know, really want to read deep into this, the title of the article, it's actually from a guy who's on LinkedIn, but the Hebrew alphabet and the Elder Futhark runes. Very interesting article. But then let me go to another site. And this is a forum, it's called Above Top Secret, and they kind of deal with not conspiracy theories, but just like hidden knowledge, things that people don't talk about in the mainstream. It's kind of like a, you know, trying to be like a heady discussion board. So this guy went on in the religion, faith, and theology section, said, is the rune alphabet related to Paleo Hebrew? I was watching a video about the Hebrew alphabet, and I noticed in the drawings of the Paleo Hebrew that there was something familiar, as though I had seen it somewhere before and I remembered that. And then I had seen the rune alphabet and noticed the similarity between the two. And the Hebrew letters we see took shape during the time of the exile to Babylon, and the letters which Amos transcribed the books he had, Prophet Amos, would transcribe the books which eventually were included in the Bible. So this guy, and he goes really deep into his theories about it. Like there's a letter called Kenaz in the runes, and Kenaz in Hebrew means like hunter. And so he goes into some of the different ideas, and he actually answers a question that a lot of Jews, well, presents a possible answer to a question that a lot of Jews discuss, which is the origin of the word Ashkenaz. In the Bible, Ashkenaz is primarily referring to Germany or Europe. But Kenaz can also mean torch. So it's very interesting that this guy is saying that the Vikings may have been the original sea people that invaded Egypt and Gaza. And so this would mean that the Philistines, who we're calling the Philistines, who we call the seafaring people because they entered from the Aegean Sea, were actually on a much longer journey, and they were from Northern Europe. This is basically suggesting that the Philistines were the Vikings. Vikings were the Philistines. I've never thought about this until today, but I think it's a possibility, especially considering the fact that the Philistine had no home. I mean, did they really just live on the sea? No, they had to be coming from somewhere, and they were temporarily living at sea, right? So it makes perfect sense to me that the Vikings might actually be Philistines. But the other thing is that the Hebrew alphabet, the alphabet, was a child of the Phoenician language. And there have been recent discoveries that link the Elder Futhark to the shapes in the Phoenician language. So this guy's theory is that the rune alphabet is basically the same as Paleo Hebrew, and I had already had that theory, but I was basing it on the Skota concept rather than this idea that the Vikings went all the way there. But we know that the Vikings at least went all the way to Greece. So why couldn't they have made it to Israel? It's not that much further. It really isn't. So I think it's perfectly feasible that the Vikings might have been the actual Philistines, which would definitely make the idea of Palestinians using that name 100% white colonizers, right? But let's talk about the other side, which was my original theory about Batya and Skota. So Skota, in medieval Irish and Scottish legend, Skota or Skotia is the daughter of an Egyptian pharaoh and the ancestor of all the Gaels. She's said to be the origin of their Latin name, Skoti, but some historians say that she and her alleged ancestors and spouses was purely mythological and created to explain the name. Okay, so the internet will do this a lot. It will present information that was accepted in for many years, and then try to tell you that, well, we have some modern understanding that this everything that you ever heard before the advent of modern science was mythological. Clearly, there are anthropological mysteries here that are otherwise unexplainable. So the idea that the Skotia story is purely mythological, to me, is purely mythological in itself. The first mention of Skota in written literature was in the 12th century, and she appeared in the Irish Chronicle Book of Leinster, which is basically a history of the Celts, right? The Gaels, the Celts, the same thing. Now, listen to this story, and then this is from the Labor Gabala Éireann, which was basically the history. It's the history of the Irish. Okay, the book states that Skotia was the mother of Goidel Glas, the ancestor of the Gaels. This Skotia was the daughter of an Egyptian pharaoh, according to this book, named Kingris, a name only found in Irish legend and nowhere in Egyptian records or by those of his neighbors. So that suggests to me that Kingris is maybe a title more than a personal name, or it's like a description more than a personal name. But she marries Goidel's father, Nule, son of Phineas Farsad, a Babylonian who traveled to Scythia after the collapse of the Tower of Babel. As we know, Tower of Babel is a biblical story, right? As with Kingris, Gomer appears nowhere in the Babylonian records and is not a Babylonian name. Once again, I'm presuming that these are Gaelic words that we don't really know the meanings of, or maybe somebody does, that are actually descriptors or titles rather than proper names. So Neil, the son of Phineas, returned to Babylon as part of an effort to study the confusion of languages, which is what we're talking about right now, right? He's a scholar of languages and is invited by the pharaoh, Kingris, to Egypt to take Skota's hand in marriage. Skota and Neil's son, Goidel, who was saved by a prayer from Moses after being bitten by a snake, is said to have created the Gaelic language by combining the best features of the 72 languages then in existence. In Fordham's early Scottish version, the Gaelthelos, he calls Goidel Glas, he says he's the son of a certain king of the countries of Greece, Neolus, or Hyalos by name. He was exiled to Egypt and took service with Pharaoh, marrying Pharaoh's daughter, Skotip. The Labor Gabala Aaron describes him as Scythian. This does not appear, however, in Greek records. Other 12th century sources state that Skota was the wife of Gaelthelos, or Goidel Glas, rather than his mother, and was the founder of the Scots and Gaels after they were exiled from Egypt. Other manuscripts of the Labor Gala Aaron contain a legend of a Scotia who was the wife of Goidel's descendant, Mil Espain, of ancient Iberia. Now, there is a landmark that claims to be Scotia's grave in Munster. We don't know if it's really her grave, but I think it would be interesting to get some DNA samples. But the Gaels, known in Gaelic as Goidel and in Latin as Scoti, are said to be named after Goidel and Skota. However, historians say they were characters created to explain the names. So if the names have no other explanation, the historians are assuming that, oh, well, they just made up this story to explain it. But maybe the story is the explanation. And it's just accurate and may have some rough edges around it because it was ancient times and people, you know, were largely illiterate, things like that. You know, you get that Chinese telegram type of thing, you know, person to person. It's going to change a little bit. So, Baldred Bisset was, at least he's credited anyway, is the first to connect the Stone of Scone with the Skota Foundation legends in this 1301 work, Processus. And he puts forth an argument that Scotland, not Ireland, was where the original Skota homeland lay. So there's going to be that argument between the Scots and the Irish, which were the original Gaels, right? And I believe they still somewhat maintain that argument to this day. But the Skota's grave is a rock feature in Glen Scoitin in County Kerry, Ireland. According to the National Monument Service, following a site inspection in 1999, they concluded that it wasn't sufficient to warrant accepting that as an archaeological monument. But I think since 1999, the science has a little bit advanced, and they might be able to even take samples from that would tell them some very different things than the assumptions that were made in 1999. But let's go a little bit deeper into the Exodus, right? So this was from a Christian website. But this is Gaelthelos, Skota, and the Exodus. And it's also, again, a very long article. I'm not going to go into reading all of it. But essentially, it's saying that we should examine this in greater detail, particularly their connection to the time of Moses and the Exodus. So it's been talked about by many different people that the Gaels, the Celts, are somehow related to the ancient Egyptians. Now, of course, we know that the Egyptians of today are primarily, after Arab colonization, are primarily all have some Arab blood. But if you want to talk about the Ayers and the Celts in relationship to that, we would be talking about the very ancient Egyptians. And so therefore, we would have to be comparing their DNA to like mummies, right? We wouldn't compare it to, you know, somebody who's alive in Egypt today. So that is a scientific experiment I would be in support of and very interested to see the results of. But if you put that all together, okay, so the Celts are descendants, at least partially, of Egyptians. And the British have this idea that they are descendants of the Israelites. So let's look at that side of it a little bit. How believable is that? From the 1870s forward, numerous independent British Israelite groups and organizations were set up throughout the British Empire, as well as in the United States. And there were still some of these organizations active in the 21st century. Now, in the United States, this concept, they try to associate it primarily with the Christian identity movement, which is a very racialized and often racist movement. However, the basic concept of British Israelism didn't go into that. That's like a neo version. But listen to this. Earliest recorded expressions, according to Brackney and Fine, the French Huguenot magistrate, Le Loyer, he had a book called The Ten Lost Tribes. It was published in 1590. And it basically posited the idea that Anglo-Saxon, also Celtic, Scandinavian, Germanic, and associated peoples were direct descendants of the Old Testament Israelites. Anglo-Israelism is another name that they use for it. And it's also been attributed to King James, who's reported to have believed that he was actually the king of Israel. Like, not, he wasn't just the king of the British, he was the king of Israel, he believed. And then there was Adrian von Schrieck, who influenced Henry Spellman and John Sadler, that wrote in the early 17th century about the ideas on the Celtic and Saxon people's origins. But he argues for an Israelite genealogy of the British people. Now, as we know, the state of Israel has always been on a mission to bring all of the Jews of the world home to Israel. And as such, there have been explorations into Africa, like the Ethiopian Jews, Beta Israel, and the Kaifeng Jews. And they found that the Igbo African tribe had genetic links to the early Jews. Of course, this doesn't make them Jewish. By Jewish law, your mother has to be Jewish or you have to convert to Judaism. But it means that they were part of a lost tribe and they would be given an easier path to conversion than, say, somebody that had nothing to do with the Jewish people who came along, right? I would like to see some of that energy applied to the British people. Let's do some DNA tests, some ancient DNA tests on the various peoples of the British Isles. And let's figure this out, guys. regardless, the idea of British Israelism, whether it's an accurate theory or not, has influenced British culture. And yes, we understand that, for example, Brits, you know, had banned actual Jews from the country for about 300 years. That was actually previous to the popularization of the British Israelism movement. It would be interesting if we found out that the people like of Shakespeare's time, when there were no Jews in England, maybe there were, but we just didn't know that they were Jews. You know, they were related to Jews anyway. So this idea that the Palestine movement tries to push that the Jewish people are the white colonizers, and they're Europeans, and they're coming to steal the land from the Arabs who are indigenous. And we know that obviously Arabs come from the Arabian Peninsula, not Israel. But that narrative, to me, seems actually backwards. It's not that Jews as a whole are white people. However, it might be that white people at one point were Jews. And as they migrated during the exile, all of these different groups of people were influenced by the Jews, right? So it's very interesting when you think about it, because maybe every conflict in the world could possibly be related to this original conflict between the Egyptians and the Israelites. What do you guys think about that? I would like people to respond to the ideas about these theories. But meanwhile, I'm going to take a break here. I'm going to play this amazing advertisement, and I'll return shortly with some more discussion.
Are you tired of being bullied for having a whack-ass, boring wardrobe? Answer is simple. Get some style. Stop dressing like a chump. Get you some stylish gear from Fight League. T-shirts, sweatshirts, stickers, and much, much more. Merch.fightweek.com. Look around and get rid of that whack-ass t-shirt you're wearing. You know you want to join the cool kids gang. Fightweek.com now!
So as you saw there, yes, there are some really cool shirts available. Some of the newer designs are actually not in that ad. I would appreciate if you go and check them out. And also please donate at donate.fightwing.com. This stuff, the media, the music, and the podcasting is currently my primary source of income, since I can't walk that well, and I'm I guess what they consider disabled now. So while I'm trying to get approved as a official disabled person, we would appreciate the support if you do donate, buy t-shirts, buy music, etc. Now back to the topic at hand. The British, the Irish, the Jews, all of these groups have always had a very interesting relationship. But I think that British Israelism is part of why the Brits fought the Nazis so hard? Because they believed that, like, that they were like Jews, and like if Hitler discovered their Jewish origins, he would wipe them out too. There's something to that. Now, I wanted to present something. I'm going to see if it's going to give me a technical issue, but let's try and watch this.
Each time a footnote appears, you'll hear this sound.
And there are no
after the webcast, you can check out the supporting material using the footnote links you will find below the screen.
But pay attention to this and listen.
Right, check this out. Jew. Jews. The Jews. Something happened inside of you, right? In your gut. You reacted. Everybody does, because the idea, even just the word, is something that no one's indifferent to. But why? After 4,000 years of recorded history, we should have figured out what this strange universal hatred of the Jews is, but we haven't. And actually, we haven't even really tried. The thing is, we're going to have to, because the way that the world is now, everything affects everyone, and there is no place to hide, so this little problem isn't so little anymore. That innate, deadly hostility is exploding around the world right now. And if we don't figure it out, it's going to trigger a violent self-defense reaction that's going to end up destabilizing the planet and harming everyone. So, let's stop pretending and fantasizing. Let's look at facts, because only facts can help. Let's stop and let's figure it out. Take the emotion out of it so that we can look at it, okay? Can you forget about religion or cultural attachments or social preferences, all that stuff, for just a few minutes, and let's look scientifically, you know, empirically, because there are facts. And really, the details of any phenomenon that's been going on as long as this one has are considered by science to be facts. So let's take them into account. What exactly is the Jewish problem? Is it hatred of the Jews? Is it genocide? Their right to self-defense? No, it's not. The problem is that nobody, and I mean nobody, including most Jews, know what Jews are and what their role is in the world, or even if they really have a role in the world. Well, how could the longest surviving identifiable grouping of people on Earth not know who they are? It's clear to us they're a race, because if their mother is Jewish, then they are. Yeah, but no. There were times in history when a person was a Jew only if their father was. And all you got to do is look at a bunch of Jews, and it's clear that they're a hodgepodge of races. But that's because they're a religion, right? Wrong. The majority of people who identify as Jews are secular, and the ones that we're probably most aware of are strongly anti-religious. Okay, so then maybe they are a nation state, Israel. A legal entity like Canada or the U.S. Yeah, but more Jews live outside of Israel than in Israel. So what are those Jews? You see the problem? Every definition is a contradiction. They're pacifists and they're warmongers. They're inferior and they dominate the economy. They want to take over the world. Capitalists. And no, they're communists. They only keep to themselves and they threaten racial purity through intermarriage. They killed Christ, and they're responsible for the invention of Christianity. They have a chosen people complex, and they've got an inferiority complex. So basically, what we have is an undefined, identity-conflicted human grouping that makes up less than 0.2% of the world's population, who somehow always have a disproportionate amount of worldwide attention and influence. Enough influence to impact the entire human network and all of its systems, for better or for worse, and we don't really know who they are. That's what makes us so suspicious, right? Where does the influence come from? Now, talking about that makes us squeamish. But look, if we're going to figure it out, we've got to stop saying that it's not true, because it is true. But how come? Why? And what is the influence for? But to solve this, we've got to see this thing in context, in the real dynamics of the human system. We need to get an idea of how our system works. Because that kind of knowledge will tell us not just what the Jews are, but what we are as a whole. And what we want to nail down isn't just some singular definition, because nothing in nature is. What we're really looking for is an interaction, a kind of a formula, a relationship. Okay, so let's start with a more accurate question. What are Jews, and why do we feel the way we do about them? Or, what are Jews to us? The problem is that the sciences that we use, biology, social and political sciences, they only look at pieces of the system and can only give us race, religion, and power politics to work with. And that's why those definitions of Jews cancel each other out. To find the relationship, we need a science that lets us look at the system we live in as if we weren't completely subject to the forces in it. We've got to poke our heads up out of it and look down on the whole thing, like those first pictures of the Earth taken from the moon, because it takes much more information than any partial observation can give us. So we need a holistic science that deals with organizing principles and how those principles steer the larger system. And that science is cybernetics and network science, which have been around since the middle of the 20th century, but they were mostly theoretical until we started getting some pretty groundbreaking insights recently from supercomputing and big data sets, including Google's records about voluntary human connections on the web. What we got was the first evidence-based perspective on the development of systems in nature. But these scientists couldn't make productive use out of all of this until they had a workable mathematical model that came from a complete data set. And they found that by accident in the 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon game, which is based on the assumption that Kevin is the most connected actor in the network of Hollywood. It turns out that Sean Connery is, but that's not the point. The model and the game work because they use only the closed world of Hollywood actors. You play the game by finding the shortest route of connection between any actor that appeared in a Hollywood film and Kevin Bacon. You should try it because you'll see that the math always works out to a number of 6 steps or fewer. You know, silly as that is, it's really important. So let's look into that a little bit first before we look directly at what the Jews are. That 6 degree thing was a eureka moment because now they had a clean and complete data set of a small system. And they could see the mechanisms and forces that make that system survive or collapse. What they found was actually the structure of survival itself. Now, there are new findings, and the details keep getting refined, but the broad strokes are clear in that. Nature develops its parts from simple systems to complex ones by predictable patterns called scale-free networks. So any scale-free network that can communicate with all of its parts within 6 or fewer steps or degrees of separation is called a small world. And it can become massively efficient. It can survive almost any attack, and it can grow in quantity and quality complexity if it's made of nodes and hubs, which I'll explain in a moment, and only if the number of hubs and nodes fit into a special ratio. And this is the ratio. Now, using this formula, we can expose what's called the degree distribution of hub to node in any scale-free system. Now, I'm not going to get into the math, but what's important is that it lets us look right into something that used to be hidden. This changes the way we see, and what we see is truly miraculous. Scale-free small world networks are everywhere. In fact, everything is made this way. Superclusters, filaments, galaxies, solar systems, the molecular mapping of proteins in our genes, the building blocks of matter itself. because nature builds things that way, and it even does it through us, showing up unconsciously in all human creations that involve systems and networks, like the electrical grid in the U.S., or the global airport structure, highway systems, the way that international business works. Even the structure of the internet and social media falls within the parameters of this formula, which is lots of nodes, very few hubs. That is the most efficient way to make and maintain any complex system in our reality. Okay, so here's what nodes and hubs are. Nodes are the elements of a system, like its resonance. Everything that happens in a system happens only for the well-being of the nodes, the individual and collective advancement of the network. Hubs are hyper-connected nodes, and they do the critical function of passing information and resources all through the system in the fastest, the most efficient way possible. And that's what makes the system survive, because it's able to respond holistically and instantaneously all through the network to any need or challenge. So a system can lose a lot of nodes and still survive as long as the minimum hub-to-node ratio holds. But as soon as the number of hubs drop below the ratio, you get system breakdown. And if enough of the relatively small number of hubs are destroyed or for some reason weaken in their function, the system fails and it collapses. So what does any of this have to do with what are the Jews to us? Well, if that's how nature does things and it's in us and all around us, then why would it not apply to the architecture of the human family? Why wouldn't it apply to the relationships and attitudes between us that come from those same mechanisms, producing the same good or bad results for the same reasons? Gossip and news buzz between us that way. Diseases spread around the planet in days based on those properties. So obviously, yes, hubs and nodes do exist between human beings. And like everything else, we are a natural structure built a certain way by those immutable natural laws. We didn't make the system, and we can't unmake its structure without messing it up or destroying it or ourselves. Because it's not some objective thing out there separate from us. The network is what we are. If, for just a few minutes, we can suspend our regular mechanical emotional reactions and try to think of the names that we call ourselves as scientific terms, then maybe the fog and fear and that prejudice can clear, and we can apply all this to the human network and begin to understand that relationship that we're searching for. So, what are Jews and why do we feel the way we do about them? What are Jews to us? The Jews are the hubs. Because for as long as we've collected population stats, there's always been a 0.02 ratio of Jews to world population. Now, those stats are not a clean data set, but at least now we can see the importance of that proportion that's always been there. No other grouping comes even close to their degree distribution throughout the network. But that number alone in itself isn't proof. What's far more important and eye-opening is that besides fitting into that ratio, there is additional evidence that Jews may have consistently and exclusively performed the analogous function to the hubs, and that that performance appears to have spanned the entire life of our current human system. So, did they? And does it? Why is it that from the time we humans first became a complex system called civilization, the history of the Jews has uniquely been one of invasions, exiles, genocide, and forced mixture into the expanding empires of the time? Why, while other peoples stayed put when their borders were disrupted by these network changes, the Jews were never allowed to isolate in their land for long? Why was it that whenever the human system grew, they in particular were scattered? And why did they always carry with them something that didn't yet exist in those places? An educational system that resulted in educated, cohesive satellite communities connected by mutual support and centered around responsibility to others. And the very principle of the function that they serve is evident in their educational texts that point to and explain their role in the system. You remember those stories? The Egyptian exile. You see Joseph. He's a prime minister and he's a steward. He's distributor of resources. There's Moses, who is the adopted prince and the liberator of humanity. In the Babylonian exile, you have Daniel, also prime minister. Mordecai, who turns out to be the protector of the king's life and the liberator. What does that point to? Not the king, not the principle of expansion and separation. It points to the principle of cohesion and connection, whose only job is taking care of the needs of the kingdom's parts, the Jew function. And clearly, looking at history, it wasn't a role that they chose. It was imposed on them by the formula or the force that evolves systems. And it appears to have worked like this. The Roman Empire swallows up the small networks, which are the nations around the Mediterranean. Jews are pushed out to the centers of the New World and into the East. When the empire recedes, they find themselves restricted just about everywhere by laws preventing integration, preventing owning property or working in almost any profession. So what's left? They are relegated to being tax and rent collectors for kingdoms and governments, and that evolves over time to money lending and financing national projects. See, it was the needs and the natural suspicion in those nations that forcefully positioned Jews as the builders of an international system of finance and trade. And that carried with it the spread of resources and ideas. And that's still the case. We still feel that Jews dominate the network that informs and connects us. Hollywood, social media, the arts, news, the electronic media, financial markets, science, patents. Add to this their unique perpetual survival, and the evidence points to Jews, whether by ideology, birth, conversion, or just people who have the exact inclination as the Jew, whether they know it or not, are actually the function of hubs in the human network. And here's the kicker. It's an integral holistic system. So every one of us has both qualities of hub and node. Let's call them the Jew function and the Gentile function, operating within us and around us. Do Jews know that this is what they are? Very, very few would, considering the disconnected state of the world right now, because it's clear that our hubs are barely able to maintain the existence of the system. It's pretty shaky. The Jew function is sleeping. So no, they're just as confused as everyone else as to what purpose they serve and why they have such influence and attract such irrational hatred. What are they supposed to be doing? Well, we've recently learned that networks are always evolving and complexifying. It appears that the human network also exists and is expanding in a natural system of higher quality that we are growing into, a more inclusive aspect of nature that manages the system below it the way that a brain manages a body. And in this mechanism, Jews are a kind of nation of hubs in the human network. And that nation, which is a relationship, is structured so that any major impulse of network development that's supposed to enter the system has to first pass through the hubs, through the Jew function. And for that to happen, though, Jews have to connect up in a way that their relationship to each other resembles the more coherent quality of the higher system where those impulses originate. They should be connecting up in an open, inclusive, mutually responsive, and altruistic way, a sort of quantum love your neighbor as yourself program. This should be a conduit made of human unity that minimizes the resistance to those development-enhancing impulses from entering the system and maximizes the spread and absorption of new ideas to every node. What it conducts to the system is a natural inborn grasp felt within the nodes of ideas and confidence about what next step to take for development and survival. It gives a sensation of wholeness, inspiration, and purpose, and that's what's missing now. What exactly are nature's messages that are coming from that higher system? Well, they're the same in all scale-free networks. The message is connect and make whole, because nature evolves its parts to handle more connection, making them more useful to the system and able to receive much more benefit from each of those enhancements. And apparently, the new data shows that connection aimed at greater states of unity may be the prime directive of the system. That's the way that hubs are supposed to work. But when they don't, or when they slow down because they're acting like nodes, then a built-in alarm goes off and every node feels that there's something wrong and starts demanding what's missing. The nodes unconsciously sense that development and well-being are being choked off and that the system's in danger. These responses are autonomic and mechanical. We don't know why we're doing it, just like we don't really manage our body's organs. We don't know why we feel that. The nodes, the Gentile function, is supposed to get triggered by the system to send alarm signals to ping the hubs, to get to work because we're suffering out here. The way this mechanism shows itself with humans is in the form of anger and demand aimed at the Jews. It's a hatred that outwardly seems completely irrational, but inwardly it feels completely justified. That's what anti-Semitism is. And that's the situation that we're in right now. There's chaos and there's planet-wide problems. The fear that we feel for our survival is happening because our ability to evolve isn't keeping up with the super-accelerating global interdependence that we're already into. Because that demands a much more efficient, higher-intensity unity from our hubs. Otherwise, we can't see a future or develop ideas that are going to allow us to safely steer the system to that more advanced state of organization. So, how do we fix that? Let's look at it again. Unity is the prime directive. We hit a crossroads in development. System alarms go off, and there's an immediate, subsensory, system-wide directive to unite. But the problem is that this can happen in one of two ways, depending on which of our functions moves towards unity first. If unity is initiated by the cohesive function, or our Jew function, then we expand through free will. There's voluntary agreement that is coming from the concern for all the parts. And we get progress. We get an enhancement of quality, and we get sustainability. If the expansive function, our Gentile function, moves towards unity first, we get empires. We get national unities based on force that pit races, religions, and cultures against each other. We get an expansion, but of quantity only. You get fascism, war, and genocide. So let's look at genocide. The whole point of having hubs in a system is to evolve its nodes into hubs. But no matter how powerful and legitimate the claim against our faltering Jew function, genocide doesn't work. It's impossible to fix the problem of underperforming hubs by destroying them because it makes the system collapse. All you got to do is look at a history book to see what happened in places that tried to do that. The negative effects are almost immediate because hubs can't be replaced en masse or really at all because hubs are how nature evolves nodes to become hubs. And what would we replace them with? Because Gentile and Jew functions are not self-appointed roles. They're products of natural structures. So any group of nodes that would imagine that it could work in some way that is opposed to how nature works and builds systems or sustains them just plain isn't a hub. That's why there are always Jews. And that's what Jews are to us. Nature's pattern of development is embedded into the fabric of the universe, into our surroundings, in our creations, in social structures, and most importantly, within our very selves. We all have both a node and a hub function in us that needs to be balanced for our individual and collective survival, which obviously are the same thing. So there we go. The Jewish problem isn't one of culture or religion or race or nationalism. It is an integral role of nature. And anti-Semitism is this deeply programmed need of the system to survive. And that motivates the suspicion and hatred for Jews. And the only way to fix this problem is to understand ourselves. Really, all that's missing now is the real human quality, the volitional conscious agreement of all the parts of the system to develop according to our roles. Nature's prime directive is unity, and that's what we're here for, and that's how we grow. And we see it everywhere in nature, except right now, where we see the opposite tendency in the human network. So, yes, of course, we need to activate the hubs. We need to wake them up. And if you're a hub, you still have this same job, and apparently you're not even allowed to escape it. So wake up. Take responsibility, because the stakes are so much higher this time. Start building more powerful methods of care and connection that we can use, because if you don't do it, no other part of the system can. So, let's try this again. Jew. Jews. The Jews. Was that any different? Now that we can see nature's thrust, its immutable laws, what is the point of blind pride or blind hatred, thinking that some part of ourselves isn't? Let's just acknowledge the data and start agreeing with the system's living tendency of connection for connection's sake. It's the only factor that makes systems, network structures, and people evolve, thrive, and survive.
Don't forget to check out the footnotes. Goodbye.
Okay, I hope you enjoyed that. The slides on the screen went a little bit slow behind the audio, but it's not a live action film, so I think that was all right. If you want to watch that without any potential buffering issues, you can go to the fightwing.com YouTube channel, my channel, and view it. The channel, the Connected World channel, which I originally downloaded that from, doesn't have any details about the production of that, and all the other videos on the channel have a guy that has a very thick accent. But I'm going to say, having been one of his students, I believe that the speaker there is a man named Tony Kosinek. He is a teacher, musician, songwriter. Oddly enough, he wrote the theme for the Toronto Blue Jays that they use. And it really sounds like his voice and his viewpoint that the mission of creation is unity. That coalesce with things that I also learned in the Kabbalah classes from Mr. Kosinek. So we have these people, British Israelists. You have people who identify themselves as some sort of lineage to the biblical Israelites in various cultures. Why? Why would they want to do this? Jews are persecuted around the world. Why would you want to say that you're part of something that it gets, you know, harassed all the time and you don't have to, you're not really part of it? Well, this video that I just played explains it a little bit, because when the Jew function is not active in the Jew, other nodes in the network will attempt to evolve to become hubs. And that's what we're witnessing now. And that's why you see people around the world who are now standing along with the Jews. They're also activating within themselves the Jew function within the network. If you're at all confused by that, just look up visual depictions of node and hub-based cybernetic networks, and it might help you visualize it a little bit. But essentially, the Jews of the world, many are not awake to the necessity of their Jew function. And when the network cries out, the nodes, the Gentiles, when they cry out from the system not working, the inclination is to blame the Jew because the Jew is the hub. If the Jew is not serving the Jew function, then the nodes will turn against it. But as it said in the video, genocide isn't going to work because the hubs are necessary to maintain the very existence of the network. So rather than attacking the Jews, the nodes should be helping to develop the hub function within the Jews. And that's all I have to say about that, folks. So I hope you enjoy Purim this weekend, and good night.